It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's my first time at this conference. When I was asked to attend, I thought this was going to be one of the usual conferences of 30, 40, or 50 people. And I'm just taken aback by how many people are there at this conference. I'm also especially glad that Helen Ziller is still here with us. Her party is the second largest party in the country. So she is, her party is very important to the future of South Africa. And I will try and explain why her party is important. And I'm hoping that she will help us understand what is her party going to do to get to 51% of the votes. The reason my topic is why is where is South Africa heading? Well, we all know where South Africa is today. It's in the hole. And I think we all know where South Africa is heading if the ANC continues as the majority party. It's going to be deeper in the hole. So the challenge that we are faced with as South African citizens is, what are we going to do about it? For me, I've been very happy with the analysis that has been made about what is wrong with the government, what's wrong with the ANC, what's wrong with the policies of the ANC, and what's wrong with what the ANC is doing. But what are we going to do about it? R.W. Johnson was talking about ANC activists. Well, I was in exile with the ANC, so I guess I qualify for these activists who he was denouncing and saying they are out of touch with the people. Actually, we are not quite as out of touch as he said. It's just that the activists are now the government of South Africa, and they are paid millions of rands by the taxpayer. And they are having a wonderful time with their corruption and all the things that they do. So for me, I would like us to discuss more about what we should do to get the country out of the hole. I think we know why it is in the hole. But I think we have to have a correct diagnosis of what the problems of our countries are. All of us, we go to the doctor now and then, and if the doctor gives you a wrong diagnosis of your problem, then you will never be healed. Now, Rob is a good friend of mine, but he failed his first year medical examination test. His diagnosis of what's wrong with South Africa is completely wrong. What failed South Africa and what has failed South Africa is not socialism. What has failed South Africa is nationalism. The nationalism of the Afrikaners and the nationalism of the Africans. For the last 100 years, South Africa has been ruled by nationalists. The National Party last year, in fact, was the year of many anniversaries. One of the anniversaries was 100 years since the National Party became the government of South Africa. So, and the National Party was in power for 70 years, except for a brief period when they decided to get out of power because they didn't want to fight the Nazis. except for that brief period, they have been ruling South Africa for 70 years. For the last 30 years, the African nationalists have been ruling South Africa. So we have had 100 years of nationalist rule in this country. It's not socialist rule, it is nationalist rule. So what has failed South Africa is Afrikaner nationalism, and what has failed South Africa is African nationalism. And that's what, and what is it that's wrong about nationalism? Why is nationalism failing? Nationalism preaches three things. It preaches grievance. You have to be aggrieved. The Afrikaner nationalists of the National Party were aggrieved against the British. And they were aggrieved against the descendants of the British. They were aggrieved against English-speaking South Africans. That is what nationalism does. The African nationalists were aggrieved against the Afrikaner, but they were aggrieved against the they started to be aggrieved against the Afrikaner people, not just the National Party. So nationalism preaches grievance and promotes a culture of grievance. Secondly, nationalism promotes a culture of hatred. That is one of the things that nationalism. And lastly, nationalism promotes a culture of entitlement. We've had discussions, there's been comments about black economic empowerment, which is entitlement par excellence. But what people don't know and don't understand is that black economic empowerment policies of the ANC were not developed by the ANC. They were developed by the Broederbond. It was the Broederbond that came up in the early 1990s with the policy of black economic empowerment. They used the national, they used Sanlam to set up the first black economic empowerment company called New Africa Investment Limited. Sanlam took a division, one of its divisions called Metropolitan Life, and brought in the black leaders of the anti-apartheid movement and said, "You, here is the company, you can have it." Why did they do this? They did it in order to fracture the multiracial nature of the ANC. The ANC could never have a policy of black economic empowerment because the ANC, since 1950, has been a multiracial organization. It could never have policies that favored any particular racial group, but the Broederbond and Sanlam came up with this policy. They set up New African Investments, and they got leaders of the United Democratic Front in particular, and they gave them shares in Metropolitan Life. And black economic empowerment has been a major driver of corruption in this country ever since. So you have to ask yourself, why would the Broederbond do such a horrible thing? They did it in order to weaken the incoming government of the ANC by fracturing the multiracial nature of the ANC. In 1994, I think something like 40% of the colored voters voted for the ANC. in the first democratic election. After all these policies of discriminatory policies of black economic empowerment, affirmative action, and so on, in the last election, I saw one of the studies, I think, by the Social Research Foundation, only 1.6% of the colored voters voted for the ANC. So you can see why the Broederbond came up with the policy of black economic empowerment. But why did the ANC accept this policy? The ANC leadership, it wasn't the ANC people, masses, as R.W. Johnson has pointed out so eloquently, it was not the ANC masses who accepted the policy of black economic empowerment. It was the ANC leadership who accepted the policy of black economic empowerment. Why? Because they benefit from it. But the consequence of black economic empowerment, besides driving corruption, it also is against entrepreneurship because it drives entitlement. Instead of getting the so-called African middle class to become entrepreneurs, it gets them to become very wealthy from getting shares from existing businesses. Huge amounts of money are allocated into black economic empowerment deals. If black economic empowerment was of any good to the economy of South Africa, we wouldn't be sitting with 40% unemployment with all these wealthy black people like Cyril Ramaphosa, Saki Macozoma, I don't know who else. These are the beneficiaries of black economic empowerment. It is a black economic empowerment is a parasite on the existing economy of South Africa. It is parasitic on the economy of South Africa, and it is destructive of value in the economy of South Africa, and it should be gotten rid of. Now, how do we get rid of it? So, we have to get rid of the people of South Africa. The voters of South Africa have gotten rid of nationalism. What happened on the 29th of May last year was the big, great majority of the voters and of the African voters of South Africa rejecting nationalism. They gave the African nationalists a chance for 30 years to run the country, and they ran the country into a hole. So that is why we are seeing the end of nationalism. Now, I said I'm happy that Helen is here. Her party is the second largest party in the country, and it is not a nationalist party. However, the question that now that the voters have rejected the National Party, they have rejected the ANC, we left with one party. That is a serious party. We have a multiplicity of unserious parties, but we are left with one serious party in the country, which is the Democratic Alliance. But now, what is the Democratic Alliance going to do to get the 51% of the votes that it needs to run the government of the country? Because today, the DA is being used to perpetuate the ANC. I'm not saying it shouldn't be in the government of national unity, but one of the effects, there are lots of positives about the DA being in the government of national unity, but there are also negatives. And one of the negatives is that it perpetuates the ANC to stay in power and to continue destabilizing the economy of the country with its policies. So what I would like to see come out of this conference is what is the plan of action to get the second largest party, which is not a nationalist party, to get to 51% of the vote. But we need a program of action, and we need more about what we who are here in this room, what are we being asked to do? Not what are we talking about, what's going wrong, but what are we being asked to do? So at least we have, I don't know how many other leaders of other political parties are here besides the DA, but I think we need those political leaders who are here to also come and tell us what do they think should be done to, instead of continuing to keep the ANC involved in power, it should go to the opposition benches. Now, what is wrong with nationalism? I've tried to explain what's wrong with nationalism. But nationalism is very powerful. We are seeing it in the United States today with the Republican Party. Nationalism is a very powerful emotion. Nationalism drove the Nazis to power. That was the horse that the Nazis rode on its back to get to power. So nationalism is capable of huge atrocities and genocide and huge destruction. So it's not a small matter that nationalism in South Africa is being rejected by the voters. We have to thank the voters before nationalism in South Africa morphs and changes and becomes like the xenophobic nationalism and the hate, the driver of hatred that it is becoming in the United States and that it became in Germany in the 1930s. The grievance within nationalism is a very powerful emotion. And this has to be fought against, and it has to be overcome. The culture of grievance in South Africa has been entrenched during the last 100 years amongst the Afrikaans population and amongst the African population. And this culture has to be addressed. And it has to be addressed practically, not just talked about, but we have to address the culture of grievance in this country. And it goes, as I said, with the culture of entitlement that we see in South Africa. Now, what form does entitlement take in the South Africa of today in the ANC? It takes the form of affirmative action. What affirmative action does in South Africa has been so destructive of our economy. Today, the South African civil service, which is essentially an African civil service, other than a few specialized professionals like in health, for example, but it is predominantly, certainly at the middle to the upper echelons of its management, is manned by the African middle class. The South African public service, according to the latest study by the International Monetary Fund, 2 years ago, the International Monetary Fund was asked interestingly, by the South African government to study the civil service, the public service. And what the IMF found was that the South African public service is the highest paid in the world. 16% of South African gross domestic product goes to the salaries of the public service in this country. Similar countries to South Africa at similar level of development, such as Thailand in Asia, Chile in South America, only 6% of GDP goes to the public, to pay the public service. So we ask ourselves, why is our economy not growing? The reason our economy is not growing is because the profits from the private sector are being siphoned off through the tax system and paid out as salaries for consumption to the public service. When our economy was growing in the early 2000, investment as a percentage of GDP was 25%, between 23 and 25% of GDP. Today, investment is only 15% of GDP in South Africa. Why? Because if we took that 10%, that 10% of GDP, which is being eaten up by the public service salaries, and put it back into investment sector in the economy, we would have 25% of investment as a percentage of GDP, which means our economy would be job creating, it would be reducing our unemployment and the levels of poverty and the levels of social welfare that we are sitting within the economy. So the first action that has to be implemented, and I'm glad that during the last failed budget presentation, the leader of the DA pointed out this matter, pointed out that there is an inflated and a bloated public service expenditure in the country. Well, one of the first things that needs to be articulated is that the cost of the public service must be cut at least in half. The cost of the public service in South Africa is destroying the economy, is destroying the ability of the economy to invest by taking the surplus from the private sector and giving it, instead of being invested, is giving it for private consumption in the public sector, by the public sector. And what do these public servants who getting these hugely inflated salaries do with their salaries? They buy imports. When you look at the cars that the same leaders of the civil service are driving, none of them buy cars made in South Africa. When you meet the so-called Blue Light Brigade, there isn't a single car in their convoys that is made in South Africa. They are whole imported, fully made up. I was in China once, and I asked one of my hosts in the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, what car does the president of China drive? He drove a five series BMW made in China. The president of South Africa, I don't know what make of SUV they drive. None of them are made in South Africa. We do make SUVs in South Africa, but this guy don't buy South African products. Secondly, because of the huge amount of money that is going to the public service, our country is deindustrializing. Industrialists are not able to keep up with the modern technology for their factories. So the factories are falling more and more behind in terms of their technology and in terms of their ability to be competitive. The consequence is that the market that South Africa should be most competitive in, which is the African market, actually the Chinese are capturing that market from South Africa. Why? Because we are not investing in the technology in our companies that we need to invest in. I can go on and on about what needs to be done. But my point is that what we need to hear from is not from me as an analyst. We need to hear from our political leaders like Helen Zille what should be done, to a program of action that we, this citizens, should do, action in order to get our country out of the trap which it has been entrapped in by the nationalists in this country over the last 100 years. I thank you, ladies.
Well, let's see. Thank you. That was insightful, interesting, honest, brutally honest, as always, and lots of questions have already come through. I guess the one thing that did kind of puzzle me a little bit, you said in the most recent elections, South Africans rejected nationalism. But if you add up the Nationalist Party of MK and the Nationalist Party of the EFF and the ANC, it's about the same as it was before. Can you just unpack that for us and explain how they rejected the nationalism?
Nobody expects EFF to become the government of South Africa. What you are seeing is a protest vote. Nobody is expecting the MK party to be the government of South Africa. This is a protest vote for the main party, against the main party. So that's why I'm saying the voters have rejected nationalism. They are not expecting EFF and MK party to become the government.
Before we go to the questions, I'd love to get your thoughts. What Bill Johnson was saying a little bit earlier about the activists and being dissociated with the vast majority of South Africans, and we know it's not the first time we've heard this. We've heard it from the IRR over decades, that South Africans are conservative Christians, 86% claim to be Christians. They work on those values, and they are not associated with the values that are projected by those who are benefiting from the system, which you articulated very well. But how do you make that connection? How do political parties make that connection to the people without breaking the ANC completely?
Well, why should you worry, or why should the voters worry about whether the ANC is broken or not broken? What the voters want is a future for their children, so that their children are better off than they are. They want stability in the country so that there is no crime, so that women can walk on the street at night without being raped. That's what the voters want. If the ANC cannot deliver, the ANC had promised it would deliver that. I was one of those who was making those promises that we would deliver that. We failed to do so. So the voters are saying no to the ANC.
So are you now saying that that's the opportunity for the second biggest party?
Yes, that's why I was saying I'm glad Helen is here, because at least she can hear that her challenge is to create is to transform the DA into a 51% party. Because that's what we have to be, that's what our constitution allows for. Continuing with coalitions which include the ANC is not going to take the country anywhere. It provides temporary stability, but this is temporary stability. It will not bring about the economic change that we need to be brought about, because the ANC will use its leverage within the government of unit of national unity to block the economic changes that are necessary.
Helen did ask a question of you. She says, Mr. Mbeki, in a proportional representation system, parties do not normally get above 50%. Proportional representation creates coalition politics. Could you comment on this, please?
But we shouldn't be having a pure proportional representation system. This was agreed at CODESA that after the first election, there will be introduction of constituency systems of one form or another. And if you remember, the late Professor Van Zyl Slabbert was appointed by Parliament to come up with a proposal that includes constituencies. Now, the ANC has been opposing the introduction of constituencies. So what we have to do to be fighting for amongst ourselves, that all of us in this room should be fighting for the introduction of constituencies. The constitution is clear that there has to be proportionality, yes, but the constituency system has to be introduced. So I agree that as long as we have the present system, then that's the trap, which traps all of us into the apron strings of the ANC, if you wish. That's why the ANC has been opposing the introduction of constituencies, because they don't want the citizen to choose their own member of parliament.
No applause. Thank you. I thought that was a brilliant. Van Zyl Slabbert, the late Van Zyl Slabbert was a giant of South African politics, and there was a lot in that report that maybe we should be dusting it off and bringing it to the fore so that the politicians are reminded of what was promised. And perhaps that is the most important thing that can come out of this conference. Gert Goos, who you might recall was the COO at the Industrial Development Corporation, and he's a regular at these events, asks this question. He says, are considerations being given to reducing the number of provinces and the number of ministers or deputy ministers? It's terribly wasteful.
Well, that is a small part of the public service. The big part of the public service, where this 16% of GDP is going to, is a layer at the top of the public service. Of course, the ministers and the deputy ministers are part of that layer. But we shouldn't chase red herrings. The real problem is the phenomenal salaries in the middle to the upper section of the management of the public service, whether it is state-owned enterprises, and then the incredible inefficiency and incompetence of these people. That's why we're having collapsing municipalities, is that class is paid phenomenal salaries as municipal managers, as CEOs of Transnet, and as directors general of umpteen different ministries, directors, deputy directors, chief directors, and so on and so forth. That's who we should target. The size of the cabinet, yes, it's inflated and it's overpaid, but it's a red herring. It won't solve the problem of that 10% of GDP that we want out of public service salaries.
So are you proposing a chainsaw Malay type of approach to South Africa from Argentina, repeating what Javier Milei has done in Argentina, taking the chainsaw, cutting the public service down? I think he went from over 20 down to 10 ministries. We've got how many? 32 or 36? Anyway, who knows? You stop counting after 10, I guess. Is that what you're proposing?
No, I'm proposing that 10% of GDP that is the cost of the public service must be transferred back to the private sector as investment. Now, how you do it, whether you do it by cutting the cabinet in half, that on its own will not do it. These are huge amounts of money that we're talking about. That on its own will not do it. So we have to do a major overhaul of the salary structure of the public sector in South Africa. Going to the municipalities, going to the metros, going to the central government, to the provinces, to the state-owned enterprises. You know, a few years ago, Alec, I visited a Chinese state-owned enterprise that made locomotives. At the time, I was on the board of a small company in Transnet that was doing railway concessions in other African countries. It was called Komaza. So we were bidding for a concession to run the railway line from Djibouti to Addis Ababa. So I was sent to go to a Chinese manufacturer of locomotives in Sichuan to see if they could make the locomotives we needed with the gauge that we needed and so on. The company employed 10,000 people, was making locomotives for export, even to Germany. They were even supplying locomotives to Germany. They were supplying locomotives to our mining industry in South Africa. They were a big international trading company. It was state-owned. I got there on a Sunday because of my travel schedule and other things I had to do in China. The whole management of that state-owned company took me out to lunch on a Sunday. So I asked them, this is incredible. In South Africa, it never have happened. The senior management would be out playing golf or stealing money. But now you, the Chinese, are taking me out. Then I asked the CEO, how much money do you earn? You won't believe this. The guy had a master's degree in mechanical engineering. He was earning an equivalent of 300,000 rands a year. Brian Mulife at the time was CEO of Transnet. I think he was earning 6 million rands a year. So that puts you in perspective the huge damage that is being done to the economy of South Africa with this hugely inflated salaries to the public service.
Dirk Kotze says, fantastic point on the 16% of GDP being spent on the public service. Problem is, unions are deeply ingrained in the ANC. How do you suggest this is broken?
Well, I think the ANC should have broken with the unions a long time ago, the Triple Alliance a long time ago. The damage that its relationship, for example, with the South African Democratic Teachers Union, that is doing to the public education system of the children is immeasurable. So, however, this is now academic because the voters have rejected the ANC and its trade union supporters. So that's a rather academic question now. The point is that they are no longer the government. they are kept in power through the government of national unity, and especially by the Democratic Alliance. So the Democratic Alliance has to make demands on the ANC.
And what about the argument that was given to us a couple of times already, that the alternative to the government of national unity is too ghastly to contemplate?
Well, there is no alternative to the government of national unity. In real terms, the ANC and EFF won't work together. That's why the EFF broke away from the ANC. The MK party won't work together with the ANC. So in reality, the DA has a huge amount of power in the government of national unity, because there is no alternative. Many people like to imagine that there was an alternative of an ANC, EFF, ANC, MK party. There isn't such a... Jacob Zuma hates the ANC leadership. They are the ones who removed him as president of South Africa. Malema hates the ANC leadership. They removed him as president of the ANC Youth League. So they can never work together. So that is the reality of our situation, which we are sitting with.
Until the next ANC leadership elective conference, where the man who's coming here tomorrow, Paul Mashatile, and I'm going to ask him this question because we've heard it repeated many times, and there's a belief that were he to be the president of the ANC, he would coalesce with the MK and the EFF.
Well, I don't know what Paul will say. First, I don't know if he will be president of the ANC. I doubt he doesn't know either. And secondly, even if already the ANC is sitting at 32% in the latest opinion poll, so if he teams up with the MK party, that won't give him 51%. So the reality is the ANC is on its way out. The real question is, what is the DA, which is a critical player in the politics of the country? How is it using the space that we have between now and 2027, when the ANC has a new president, and then between now and 2029? What is it going to do to get to 51%?
So if I read you correctly, it's almost like the DA is not using the muscle, or maybe does not understand what muscle it has in the government of national unity.
Well, in front of a leader of the DA, I've been reluctant to agree with you, but I think...
No, I'll ask the question.
I agree with you that the DA has a lot of muscle in the government of national unity. Okay, it used it over the budget the last time on February the 19th. So I think it is learning that it does have a lot of muscle. So hopefully we'll see it using that muscle in more areas as well.
And actually, in your defense, you did say that coalitions have just started. And effectively, we will see a very interesting... It'll be interesting to see what happens in the budget this afternoon, whether or not... Well, we need not speculate there. Dirk van der Walt asked, well, if they're going to talk about nationalism, please, then you can't exclude the theme of the communist that went hand in hand with nationalism. Those things are old. It feels irrelevant today. In other words, nationalism irrelevant today. That would align with what you're talking with.
Yes, I mean, the Communist Party in South Africa is a tiny little faction within the ANC. It has no standing of its own with the voters. So I think it's largely... They are threatening to stand on their own in the coming local government elections. Well, let's see what they do, but I don't think they will get any support.
The selfishness of apartheid led to the selfishness of the ANC, despite the big tent ideology of the Freedom Charter. We need to stop blaming. Would you agree with that comment?
Yeah, I agree completely.
Mark Thompson asks, would the constituency system deal with the ANC conference system? In other words, at the moment where we have political assassinations for people to get further up on the list, largely related to the patronage that can be dispensed when you're in that situation. Interesting that Bill Johnson was saying at the last elective conference, your vote was worth 10,000 Rand. So if you got voted within the organization to go to the elective conference, those 4,000 people, then that was a pretty nice place to be. If the end of the current system that we have, where the parties send people to parliament, if that were to be changed in the way that the Van Zyl-Slabbert report suggested, would that deal with those issues?
Well, I don't know. You see, it depends on the culture of each party. Because a constituency system might entail a primary within each party as to who should stand for the MP, the DA. Let's say we have a constituency in Hermanus. And all the parties are contesting the constituency. Now, if a party has a culture of assassination of its members, amongst its members, then it will do so if there is a primary. But not all parties in South Africa have that problem.
Helen's response is that the ANC has higher support than 32%. The methodology of the SRF did not allocate doubtful voters, which creates a misleading result. And I remember when they brought it out, there were two very important things which I'd love you to comment on. The one was that there was a belief now that after the ANC dropped below 50%, there was a prior belief that there would be lots of violence. That didn't happen. And that has emboldened many ANC voters to leave the party. And the second point was that 15% of previously staunch ANC supporters are now saying, well, we're up for grabs, and hence the 32%. Those two points, when push comes to shove, might those 15% go back naturally to the ANC?
No, I don't think so. I don't think. Because first, remember, the ANC is an old party. Its membership, people like myself, are three or four generations, their families in the ANC. So to decide not to vote for the ANC takes a huge amount of emotional debate within yourself. But once that decision is taken, that's it. You won't go back. It won't happen again. That is the vulnerability of the ANC, is that it has a lot of strengths with the voters because of the multi-generational nature of their voters. But once that breaks, which has happened now, it can't come back. That's why parties like the ANC, like Kaunda's party, for example, Nkrumah's party in Ghana, once the voter breaks with them, they're finished. They don't go back, because the emotion that goes into making that decision to break with them is very painful, because of it's like changing your religion. It's like moving from one church to another church. It's a very painful, I haven't done it, but I presume it's very painful. So that's why they won't go back to it, because they don't want to go through that repeated experience.
We've got 7 minutes left, and I would like you now to put on your cap as the chairman of the of international affairs. It's a highly respected body. And right now, there is much confusion in South Africa about the relationships that we have in the international community. Can you unpack for us, please, where we are, what we're doing wrong, and perhaps where we should be going?
Well, this is a very big question, Alex. So I don't know. First, I don't know if I have the answer, but well, first, we have to look at our relationship with the United States. The United States is the biggest economy in the world, is the biggest military power in the world. We have over 600 American companies in South Africa. We all drink Coca-Cola, which is an American product, and so on. So South Africa is very intertwined with the United States. The mistake that the ANC has made is that it never, after 1994, it stopped making investment in building relations between the United States government, United States Congress, United States students, civil society, and so on, and South Africa. That has been one of the major mistakes of the ANC, because the ANC was part, and ANC members who were students in the United States, they were part of the campaign that persuaded the United States Congress, both Republican and Democrats, to vote for sanctions against the apartheid government in 1986. The Republicans, remember in 1986, the United States had a Republican president, which was Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan vetoed the first bill of sanctions, which was predominantly Democrats. He vetoed that bill. But the Republicans were mobilized under the leadership, I think the then leader of the Senate was Lugard, the leader of the Republicans. And they rallied behind the sanctions bill, and the sanctions bill was passed over President Reagan's veto. Now, instead of the ANC building on that goodwill, it abandoned that. That was point number one. Point number two, the decision to get a negotiated settlement. One of the major decisions for the negotiated settlement was made at a meeting, at a summit between Gorbachev of Russia and Reagan. Reagan said to Gorbachev that he has to stop arming liberation movements in Southern Africa, including the ANC. And Gorbachev's reply was that we, the Russian communists, have made enormous investment in the ANC. If we abandon the ANC before apartheid is gone, we are going to pay a price with the Russian people. So Reagan had to give an undertaking to Gorbachev that there was going to be a negotiated settlement in South Africa. That was one of the key meetings where the decision for a negotiated settlement was made. This was at the summit in Iceland between Gorbachev and Reagan. So the United States has been very important to South Africa. There was time when the ANC, they sent an ambassador there who got sick, and this ambassador, I won't give you the name, got dementia, and they didn't remove the ambassador from the United States. So the problems we have with the United States are not the problems of South Africa, and they're the problems of the ANC. So those who are talking to the Americans, have to point out that AGOA is not a program for the ANC. It's a program for the private sector of South Africa, which employs 75% of South Africans employed are employed by the private sector. And they, if they pull out or force the ANC out of AGOA, it's the private sector that will suffer. Now, somebody pointed out that Reagan doesn't read. I don't know, was it you?
No, Trump doesn't read.
Yes, pointed out that Trump doesn't read. So maybe there has to be more education of Trump and his fellow Republicans. I don't know, the cowboy like Elon Musk, whether he's educatable. But that is the reality, is that they have to, the current administration has to be educated by all of us to understand the difference between South Africa and the ANC.
Moletsi Mbeki, it's been a privilege. Thank you.
Now you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence. Renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise, our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.